The capsule slid up out of the park's chuteway at the back of the building and zipped up into the nearby traffic stream. Police sentience queried it, and Aaron's U-Shadow provided them with a genuine owner certificate code. Corilyn stared down at the sluggish mass of boiling dust behind them. Her limbs had stopped trembling. He was not sure if that was the mild suppressor drug he had given her, finally flushing the aerosol out of her system, or if a deeper level of shock was setting in. A small fleet of civic emergency capsules and ambulances was heading into the fane.
"They just shot at us," she said. "They didn't warn us or tell us to stop first. They just opened fire."
"I had jumped down an elevator shaft to try to get out," he pointed out. "That's a reasonable admission of guilt."
"For Ozzy's sake, if you didn't have a force field, Webb, we'd be dead. That's not how the police are supposed to act. They were police, weren't they?"
"Yeah, they're the city police, all right. But we did get out." She sounded puzzled. "There were how many?
10 of them? 20?
Something like that, yeah.
You just walked out like nothing could stop you. It didn't matter what they did."
"That's higher bionics for you. The only way standard weaponry can gain an advantage is overwhelming firepower. They weren't carrying that much hardware."
"You're higher?"
"I have weapons-grade bionics. I'm not sure about the culture part of it. That way of life seems slightly pointless to me, sort of like the pre-Commonwealth aristocracy."
"What's that?"
"Very rich people living a life of considerable ease and decadence, while the common people slaved away into an early grave, with all their labor going to support the aristocrats and their way of life."
"Oh, right."
She did not sound interested.
"Inigo was higher."
"No, he wasn't," Aaron said automatically.
"Actually, he was, but he kept that extremely quiet. Only a couple of us ever knew. I don't think our new cleric conservator is aware of his idol's true nature."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure."
"That's remarkable. There's no record of it. That's a hell of an achievement these days."
"Like I said, he kept it quiet. No one would have paid any attention to a higher showing them his dreams, not out here on the external worlds. He needed to appear as ordinary as possible, to be accepted as one of us."
Aaron gave an amused grunt. "Hires are people too."
"Some of them."
She gave him a meaningful glance. "Was Eve the other cleric who knew about Inigo?"
"No."
She drew a short gasp and glanced back.
"Oh, Ozzy, Eve. He was unconscious when the fane collapsed."
"He'll be all right."
"All right," she yelled, finally becoming animated. "All right. He's dead."
"Well, he'll probably need relifing, yeah. But that's only a couple of months of downtime these days." She gave him an incredulous snort and leaned against the capsule's transparent fuselage to gaze down on the city. Shock, anger, and fright, he decided. Mostly fright. "You need to decide what to do next," he told her as sympathetically as he could. "Team up with me or..." He shrugged. "I can give you some untraceable funds. That should help keep you hidden."
"Bastard."
She wiped at her eyes, then looked down at herself. Her red sweater had large damp patches, and the lower half of her trousers were caked in blue foam. Her knees were grazed and filthy from the inside of the utility tunnel. Her shoulders slumped in resignation.
"He used to go somewhere," she said in a quiet, emotionless voice.
"Inigo?"
"Yes. This isn't the first time he took off on a sabbatical and left Living Dream covering up for his absence, but none of the other times were for so long. A year at most."
"I see. Where did he go?"
"Anagaska."
"That's his birth world."
"Yes."
"An external world. One of the first. Advancer through and through," he said significantly.
"I'm not arguing with you."
"Did he ever take you?"
"No. He said he was visiting family. I don't know how true that was."
Aaron reviewed the files on Inigo's family. There was very little information. They did not seek publicity, especially after he founded Living Dream. His mother migrated inward a long time ago. She downloaded into ANA in 3440. After first becoming
higher. Yes, I know.
He didn't follow the point.
But for someone to convert to hire without leaving any record was essentially impossible. Corilin must have been mistaken. "There's no record of any brothers or sisters," he said. Corilin closed her eyes and let out a long breath. "His mother had a sister, a twin. There was something, I don't know what, but some incident long ago. Inigo hinted at it. The sisters went through this big trauma together. Whatever it was drove them apart. They never really reconciled."
"There's nothing in the records about that. I didn't even know he had an aunt."
"Well, now you do. So what next?"
"Go to Anagaska. Try to find the aunt or her children."
"How do we get there? I imagine the police will be watching the spaceports and wormholes."
"They will eventually. But I have my own starship." He stopped in surprise, as knowledge of the starship emerged into his mind from some deep memory. Corilin's eyes opened in curiosity.
"You do?"
"I think so."
"Sweet Ozzy, you are so strange."
17 minutes later, the capsule slid down to land beside a pad in Riasi's spaceport. Aaron and Corilin climbed out and looked up at the chrome-purple ovoid that stood on 5 bulbous legs. She whistled in admiration.
"That looks deliciously expensive. Is it really yours?"
"Yeah."
"Odd name,"
she said as she walked under the curving underbelly of the fuselage.
"What's the reference?"
"I've no idea." His U-shadow opened a link to the Artful Dodger's smart core, confirming his identity with a DNA verification, along with a code he abruptly remembered. The smart core acknowledged his command authority. "Hang on," Aaron told Corilin and grabbed her hand. The base of the starship bulged inward, stretching into a dark tube. Gravity altered around them, and they slid up inside the opening. Sholapur was one of those Commonwealth planets that did not quite work. All the ingredients for success and normality were there. A standard H-congruous biosphere, G-type star, oceans, big continents with great landscapes of deserts, mountains, plains, jungles, and vast deciduous forests, handsome coastlines, and long meandering archipelagos. The local flora had several plants humans could eat, and the wildlife was not wild enough to pose much of a threat. Tectonically, it was benign. The twin moons were small, orbiting 700,000 kilometers out, to produce the kinds of tides and waves that satisfied every kind of marine sports enthusiast. Physically, there was nothing wrong with it. That left the people. Settlement began in 3120, the year ANA officially became Earth's government. It was the kind of incentive that flushed a lot of the remaining political, cultural, and religious malcontents out of the central worlds. The greatest machine ever built was obviously taking over, and higher culture was now so dominant it never could be revoked. They left in the millions to settle the farthest external worlds. At 470 light-years from Earth, Sholapur was an attractive proposition for anyone looking for a distant haven. To begin with, everything went smoothly. There was commercial investment, the immigrants were experienced professionals, cities and industrial parks sprang up, and farms were established. But the groups that arrived from the central worlds weren't just dissatisfied with higher culture. They tended to be insular, intolerant of other ideologies and lifestyles. Petty local disputes had a way of swelling to encompass entire ethnic or ideological communities. Internal migration accelerated, transforming urban areas into miniature city-states, all with massively different laws and creeds. Cooperation between them was minimal. The Planetary Parliament was suspended in 3180 after yet another debate ended in personal violence between senators, and that more or less marked the end of Sholapur's economic and cultural development. It was regarded as hermetic by the rest of the Commonwealth. Even the external worlds, with their attitude of forthright independence, viewed it as a kind of embarrassing dropout cousin. The nearest settled worlds called it Planet of the Hotheads and had little contact. Despite that, a great many starships continued to visit. Some of the micronations had laws, or a lack of laws, that could be advantageous to certain types of merchants. 5,000 kilometers above the planetary surface, the starship Melanie's Redemption fell out of hyperspace
amid a collapsing bubble of violet Cherenkov radiation. There was no single planetary traffic control Troblum could contact. Instead, he filed an approach request with Ikeo City and received permission to land. Melanie's Redemption measured 30 meters long, with a sleek, flared cone shaped with forward-curving tail fins that looked functionally aerodynamic. In fact, they were thermal radiators, added to handle the extensively customized power system. The cabin layout was a central circular lounge, ringed by 10 sleeping cubicles and a washroom. Hyperdrive ships did not come much bigger. They simply were not cost-effective to build. Starline companies used them almost exclusively for passengers wealthy enough to pay for fast transport. Most starships used a continuous wormhole drive. They were slower, but could be built to any size, and carried the bulk of interstellar trade around the external worlds. Originally, Melanie's Redemption had been a specialist craft, built to carry priority cargo or passengers between the external worlds, a risky proposition at the best of times. The company that had commissioned her had lurched from one financial crisis to another, until Troblum made them an offer for their superfast lame duck. He claimed she would be refitted as a big personal yacht, which was a white lie. It was her three large cargo holds that made her perfect for him. Their volume was ideal for carrying the equipment he was working on to recreate the Anomine one-shot wormhole. Marius had agreed to the acquisition, and the additional EMAs materialized in Troblum's account. Although the ship was supposed to remain on Arevalo until Troblum was ready to move the project to its test stage, he found it indispensable for some of the transactions in which he was involved. The addition of a Navy-grade stealth field was especially beneficial when it came to slipping away from Arevalo, without Marius being aware of anything untoward. City was a somewhat overzealous description for Ikeo, which comprised a 50-mile stretch of rugged subtropical coastline, with a small town in the middle and a lot of mansions spread along the cliff tops on either side. Ideologically, the province could best be described as a free trade area, with several individuals specializing in artifact salvage. It did have a resident-funded police force, which its poorer neighboring states referred to as a strategic defense system. Melanie's Redemption descended at the focal point of several ground-based tracking sensors. She landed on Pad 23 at the city's spaceport, a 2-kilometer circle of mown grass with 24 concrete pads, a couple of black dome-shaped maintenance hangars, and a warehouse owned by an intersolar service supply company. There were no arrival formalities. A capsule drew up beside the starship as Troblum walked down the short air stair, puffing heavily from the rush of heat and humidity that hit him as soon as the airlock opened. The capsule took him several miles out of town to a Romanesque villa atop a low cliff. Three sides of the single-story building surrounded an elaborate pool and patio area, festooned with colorful plants. Several waterfalls spilled down large, strategically positioned boulders to splash into the pool. The view down onto the white beach was spectacular, with a needle-profile glideboat anchored just offshore. Stubbsy Florak was waiting for him by the bar at the side of the pool. Not that anyone called him Stubbsy to his face. Florak was sensitive about his height, sensitive that he didn't get it changed during rejuvenation therapy, because to do that would be to admit that he was a head shorter than most adults, and that it bothered him enough to do something about it. He wore knee-length sports trousers and a simple pale blue shirt open to the waist to reveal a chest covered in hair and a stomach that was starting to bulge. When Troblum appeared, he smiled broadly and pushed his oversized sunglasses onto his forehead. His hairline was a lot higher and thinner than Troblum was used to seeing, even on external world citizens. "Hey, my man!" Florek exclaimed loudly. He held his arms out and shifted his hips from side to side. "You been dieting or what?" He laughed loudly at his own joke. All his companions smiled. There were seven of them visible in the pool area, either lying on sun loungers or sitting at the table in the shallow end of the pool, sipping drinks that were mostly fruit and ice. Troblum was always slightly uncomfortable about the girls Stubbsy kept at the villa. Not quite clones, but there were standard requirements. For a start, they were all a lot taller than their boss. Two were even taller than Troblum. Naturally, they were beautiful, with long silken hair, bodies toned as if they were part of some ancient Olympic athlete squad, and wearing tight bikinis. Dressing for dinner here meant putting on a pair of shorts and sandals. A low-level field scan revealed them to be enriched with several advanced weapons systems. Half the muscle ridges, etched beneath their taut skin, were actually force-field webbing. If they ganged up on Troblum, they probably could overwhelm his bionic defenses. They acted like a hybrid between floozies and executive assistants. Troblum knew the image the arrangement was supposed to convey, but didn't understand why. Stubbsy must have had a lot more insecurities than his height. Troblum's worn old toga suit rippled around his vast body as he raised his arms. "Do I look smaller?"
"Hey, come on, I'm just fucking with you. What I got, it entitles me."
"What you claim you've got."
"Man, just shove that stake in a little farther. I don't think it went right through my heart. How are you, man? It's been a while."
Stubbsy gave Troblum a hug, arms reaching almost a third of the way around, squeezing like he was being reunited with a parent.
"Too long," Troblum suggested. "Still got your ship, sweet ship. You hire guys. You live the life, all right."
Troblum looked down on Stubbsy's head.
"So, come and join us." "Wow-wa there. Not quite ready for that, okay? Man, don't even joke about it. I need to spend a decade wiping all my bad memories before they'd let me set foot on the Central Worlds. Hey, you want a drink? Couple of sandwiches, maybe? Alcinda, she knows how to boss a culinary unit around."
He lowered his voice and winked.
"Not the only thing she knows her way around, huh?"
Troblum tried not to grimace in dismay.
"Some beer, maybe."
"Sure, sure."
Florak gestured to some chairs beside a table. They sat down while one of the girls brought over a large mug of light beer.
"Hey, Simone, bring the case out for my man, will you?"
A girl in a vivid pink bikini gave a short nod and went inside.
"Where did you find it?" Troblum asked. "A contact of mine. Hey, have I been retrofitted without a brain and somebody not tell me? If I tell you about my people, what's left for me in this universe?"
"Quite. You know, I've got a network pumping away down there in the civilized Commonwealth. This week it's some guy, next it's another. Who knows where shit is going to appear? You want to stab me in the back? First you gotta build your own network."
"I already have."
Florak blinked, his best friend's smile fading.
"You have?"
"Sure. Hundreds of guys like you."
"You kill me, you know that?"
He laughed too loudly and raised his glass.
"People like me. Oh, man!"
"I meant, what planet was it recovered from? My record search confirmed Vic Russell handed it back in to the Serious Crimes Directorate when he returned from the Boongate relocation. It was obsolete by then. The SCD would have disposed of it."
"Beats me,"
Florak said with a shrug.
"Guess there were people like you and me around, even back in those days."
Troblum said nothing. The salvager could be right. For all his personality faults and distasteful lifestyle, he had always provided bona fide items. A large number of artifacts in Troblum's museum had come from Florak. So many returned from the villa carrying a long, stable environment case. It was heavy. Her arm muscles were standing proud. She put it on the table in front of Troblum and Stubbsy. "Before we go any further," Troblum said, "I have the SCD serial code. The genuine one. So do you still want to open the case?"
"I don't give a shit what fucking number you think you got, man. This is for real. And hey, guess what? You aren't the only asshole in the Commonwealth that creams himself over this shit. I come to you first because I figure we got a friendship going by now. You want to call me out? You want to crap all over my reputation? And you know what, fat boy? You can roll all the way back to your ship and fuck the hell off this world. My fucking world."
"We'd better look at it then," Troblum said. "I'd hate to lose your friendship." He did not care about Stubbsy Florak. There were dozens of scavengers just like him. But it was an interesting claim. He'd never really thought there were other collectors outside museums. He wondered idly if they could be persuaded to sell. Perhaps Florac could inquire. Florac's U-shadow gave the case a key, and the top unfurled to reveal an antique ion rifle. A protective shield shimmered faintly around it, but Troblum could clearly see the meter-long barrel that ended in a stubby black metal handle that had several attachment points and an open induction socket on the bottom.
"Yeah, well,"
Stubbsy said with a modest grimace that almost could have been embarrassment.
"The other bit is missing, obviously. But what the fuck? This is the business end, right? That's what counts."
"There is no other bit," Troblum said. "This is designed to be used by someone in an armor suit. Clips onto the lower arm."
"No shit."
It was an effort for Troblum to speak calmly. The weapon certainly looked genuine. "Would you turn off the field, please?" The shimmer vanished. Troblum's field function swept across the antique rifle. Deep in the barrel's casing were long chains of specifically arranged molecules spelling out a unique code. He licked the sweat from his upper lip. "It's real," he whispered hoarsely.
"Yo!"
Stubbsy slapped his hands together in victory.
"Do I ever let you down?"
Troblum couldn't stop staring at the weapon, only in the flesh. "Would you like payment now?"
"Man, this is why I love you. Yes, yes, please. I would very much like payment now, please."
Troblum told his U-shadow to transfer the funds.
"You want to stay for dinner?"
Stubbsy asked.
"Maybe party with some of the girls?"
"Put the protective field back on, please. This humidity is inimical."
"Sure thing. So, which one do you like?"
"You don't have any idea how important this artifact is, do you?"
"I know its value, man. That's what counts. The fact some policeman shot an alien with it 1,000 years ago doesn't exactly ding my bell."
"Vic Russell worked with Paula Mayo, and I know you've heard of her."
"Sure, man. This planet's living nightmare. Didn't know she was around in those days, too."
"Oh, yes. She was around even before the Starflyer War. And it wasn't an alien Vic shot. It was Tarlo, a directorate colleague who had been corrupted by the Starflyer and betrayed Vic and his wife. Tarlo is one of the most arguably important Starflyer agents there ever was."
"Ozzy, now I get it. This was the gun that killed him. That connects you."
"Something like that."
"So are you interested in genuine alien stuff as well?"
"Anything that is part of the Starflyer's legacy. Why, have you located another section of its ship?" Stubbsy shook his head.
"Afraid not, man. But one of my neighbors, she specializes in weird alien technology and other interesting little chunks. You know, the odd sample that crews on Pathfinder missions pick up. Stuff you never get to hear about in the Unisphere. Stuff ANA and the Navy like to keep quiet. You want I should put you in touch? I got a Unisphere code. She's very discreet. I'll vouch for her."
"Tell her if she ever comes across any Animine relics, I'll be happy to talk," he said, knowing she would not. "Apart from that, I'm not interested."
"Okay. Just thought I'd ask."
Troblum raised himself to his feet, quietly pleased that he did not need his bionics to generate a muscle reinforcement field. But then, this world had a 0.8 standard gravity. "Could you call your capsule for me, please?"
"Money's in, so sure. This is another reason I like you, man. We don't have to screw around making small talk."
"Exactly." Troblum picked up the stable environment case. It was heavy. He could feel a mild sweat break out on his forehead and across his shoulders as he lifted it into the crook of his arm. Hadn't Stubbsy ever heard of regrav?
"Hey, man, you're the only hire I know, so I've got to, like, ask you this. What's ANA's take on this whole pilgrimage thing? Is it a bunch of crap? Or are we all going to get clusterfucked by the void?"
"ANA governance put out a clear statement on the Unisphere. The pilgrimage is regrettable, but it does not believe the actions of Living Dream pose any direct physical threat to the greater Commonwealth."
"I accessed that, sure. Usual government bullshit done, huh? But what do you think, man? Should I be stocking up my starship and heading out?"
"Out where, exactly?
If the anti-pilgrimage faction is right, the whole galaxy is doomed. You are just one giant lump of fun, aren't you? Come on, man! Give it to me straight! Are we in the shit?
The contacts I have inside ANA aren't worried, so neither am I. Stubbsy considered that seriously for a moment, before reverting to his usual annoyingly breezy self.
Thanks, man. I owe you one.
Not really. But if I find a way to collect, I'll let you know. Troblum puzzled over Stubbsy's question in the capsule on the way back to his ship. Perhaps he had been unwise to admit to contacts inside ANA, but it was a very general reference. Besides, he didn't really consider Stubbsy to be some kind of agent working for Marius's opponents, of whom there were admittedly many. Of course, the Starflyer had procured agents a lot more unlikely than Stubbsy. But if Stubbsy was an agent for some ANA faction, they were playing a long game, and from what Troblum understood, the pilgrimage situation would be resolved sooner rather than later. Troblum shook his head and shifted the case slightly. It was an interesting theory, but he suspected he was overanalyzing events. Paranoia was healthy, but he wouldn't like to report that particular suspicion to Marius. More likely it was a genuine concern on Stubbsy's part, one born of ignorance and popular prejudice. That was a lot easier to believe. The capsule arrived back at Melanie's Redemption, and Troblum carefully carried the stable environment case into the starship. He resisted the impulse to open it for one last check, but did stow it in his own sleeping cabin for the flight back to Arevalo.
The first thing Araminta knew about the failure was when a shower of sparks sizzled out of the bot's power arm, just above the wrist multi-socket where tools plugged in. At the time, she was on her knees beside the Juliet balcony door, trying to dismantle its seized-up actuator. The unit had not been serviced for a decade at least. When she got the casing open, every part of it was covered in grime. She wrinkled her nose in dismay and reached for the small, all-function electrical toolkit she had bought from Askahar's Infinite Systems, a company that specialized in recycled equipment for the construction trade. Her U-Shadow grabbed the user instructions from the kit's memory and filtered them up through her macrocellular clusters into her brain. Supposedly they gave her an instinctive ability to apply the little gizmos. She couldn't even work out which one would stand a chance of cleaning away so much gunk. The cleaner utensils were intended for delicate systems with a light coating of dust, not this compost heap. Then, as she peered closer at the actuator components, bright light flashed across them. She turned just in time to see the last cascade of sparks drizzle down on the pile of sealant sheets stacked up in the corner of the flat's lounge. Wisps of smoke began to wind upward. The bot juddered to a halt as the whole lower segment of its power arm darkened. As she watched, its pocked, silvery casing tarnished rapidly from the heat inside.
"Ozzy's mother!" she yelped, and quickly started stamping on the sheets, trying to extinguish the glowing points the sparks had kindled.
Her U-Shadow could not get any access to the bot. It was completely dead, and now there was a definite hot oil smell in the air. Another bot slid away and retrieved an extinguisher bulb from the kitchen. It returned and sprayed blue foam on the defunct bot's arm. Araminta groaned in dismay as the bubbling fluid scabbed over and dripped onto the floorboards, soaking in. The whole wood look was coming back in vogue. That was why she had ordered the bot to abrade the original floorboards down to the grain. As soon as they were done, she was going to spread the sealant sheets while the rest of the room was decorated and fitted. Then she would finish the boards with a veneer polish to bring out the wavy gold and rouge pattern of the native antwood. Araminta scratched at the damp stain with her fingernail, but it did not seem too bad. She'd just have to get another bot to abrade the wood further. There were five of the versatile machines performing various tasks in the flat, all second or third hand, again bought from Askahar's Infinite Systems. Now that the immediate danger of fire was over, her U-Shadow called Bert Rennick, proprietor of Askahar's Infinite Systems.
"Well, there's nothing I can do," he explained after she told him what had happened.
"I only bought it from you 2 days ago."
"Yes, but why did you buy it?"
"Excuse me. You recommended it."
"Yes,
The Candel 8038. It's got the kind of power level you wanted for heavy-duty attachments. But you came to me rather than a licensed dealer.
What are you talking about? I couldn't afford a new model. The Unisphere Evaluation Library said it was dependable.
Exactly. And I sell a lot of refurbished units because of that. But the one you bought had a manufacturer's decade warranty that expired over a decade ago. Now, with all the goodwill in Aussie's universe, I have to tell you that you get what you pay for. I have some newer models in stock if you need a replacement. Araminta wished she had the ability to Trojan a sensorium package past his U-shadow filters, one that would produce the pain burst he would get from a good smack on the nose. Will you take part exchange?
I could make you an offer on any components I can salvage, but I'd have to bring the bot into the workshop to analyze what's left. I can come out, middle of next week, and there would have to be a collection charge.
For Aussie's sake, you sold me a dud.
I sold you what you wanted. Look, I'm only offering to salvage parts as a goodwill gesture. I'm running a business. I want return customers.
Well, you've lost this one. She ended the call and told her U-Shadow never to accept a call from Bert Rennick again.
Bloody hell!
Her U-Shadow quickly revised her refurbishment schedule, adding an extra 3 days to the expected completion date. That assumed she would not buy a replacement for the 8038. It was a correct assumption. The budget was not working out as she'd originally planned. Not that she was overspending, but stripping out all the old fittings and démodé decorations was taking a lot longer than her first estimate. Araminta sat back on the floor and glared at the ruined bot.
I'm not going to cry. I'm not that pathetic.
The loss of the 8038 was a blow, though. She'd just have to trust that the remaining bots would hold out. Her U-Shadow began to run diagnostic checks on them while she tried to detach the abrader mat from the 8038's foam-clogged multi-socket. The attachment was expensive, and, unlike the bot, brand new. Her mood was not helped by the current state of the flat. She had been working on it for 5 days solid now, stripping it down to the bare walls and gutting the ancient domestic equipment. The place looked terrible. Every surface was covered in fine particles, with sawdust enhancing the dilapidated appearance. Sounds echoed around the empty rooms. After tidying things today, she could start the refurbishment stage. She was sure that would refire her enthusiasm. There had been times over the last week when she had had moments of pure panic, wondering how she could have been so stupid as to have gambled everything on this ancient, cruddy flat. The abrader attachment came free, and she pulled it out. With her U-Shadow controlling them directly, two of the remaining bots hauled their broken sibling out of the flat and dumped it in the commercial refuse casket parked outside. She winced every time it bumped on the stairs, but the other occupants were out. They'd never know how the dent got there. With the abrader plugged into another bot, a Brackleff 34B only 8 years old, she turned her attention back to the balcony door actuator. She knew that if she started moping over the broken bot, she'd just wind up feeling sorry for herself and never get anything done. She could not afford that. The simplest thing, she decided, was to break the actuator down and clean the grime off manually. After that, she could use the specialist tools to get the systems up to the required standard. Her other toolbox, the larger one, had a set of power keys. She set to with more determination than she had any right to, without resorting to aerosols. As she worked, her U-Shadow skimmed the news, local and intersolar, and summarized topics she was interested in, feeding them to her in a quiet, neural drizzle. Now that she had bought the flat, she had cancelled the daily review of city property. It would be too distracting, especially if something really good appeared on the market. Dabina, the firstborn daughter of the billionaire Sheldonite Lycan, had been arrested once again for lewd conduct in a public place. Handel Industries, one of Alezalin's top companies, was discussing opening a manufacturing district just outside Colwyn. The details were accompanied by economic projections. She could not help scanning the effect on property prices. As far as intersolar political news was concerned, the only item was the new Senate motion introduced by Marion Cantill, Earth Senator,
that living dream desist from reckless action in respect to its pilgrimage. A Leselin senator responded to the motion by walking out. He was followed by the senators from Tarai, Idlib, Lirno, Kuhud, and Agra, the free trade zone planets. Araminta was not surprised to find that Vyosha's senator had abstained from the vote, as had seven other external worlds, all on the fringe of the zone and with large populations of living dream followers. The report went on to show the huge manufacturing yard on the edge of the greater Makathran, where the pilgrimage ships would be assembled. Araminta stopped cleaning the actuator to watch. An armada of civic construction machinery was laying down the field, flattening 15 square miles of countryside to get it ready for its cladding of concrete. The pilgrimage fleet was to be made up of 12 cylindrical vessels, each a mile long, and capable of carrying 2 million pilgrims in suspension. Already Living Dream was talking about them being merely the first wave. Araminta shook her head in mild disbelief that so many people could be so stupid and switch to local reports of business and celebrities. 2 hours later, Cressida arrived. She frowned down at the prints, her shiny leather pumps, with their diamond-encrusted straps made in the thick layer of dirt coating the hall floor. Her cashmere fur dress contracted around her to save her skin from exposure to the dusty air. One hand was raised to cover her mouth, with gold and purple nail print friezes flowing in slow motion. Araminta smiled up uncertainly at her cousin. She suddenly was very self-conscious standing there in her filthy overalls, hair wound up and tucked into a cap, hands streaked with black grease.
"There's a dead bot in your casket," Cressida said.
She sounded annoyed.
"I know," Araminta sighed. "Price of buying cheap. It's one of yours."
Cressida's eyebrows lifted. "Do you want me to call the supplier and have it replaced?"
"Tempting.
Ozzy knows it wasn't actually that cheap relative to my budget, but no, I'll fight my own battles from now on.
That's my family. Stupidly stubborn to the last.
Thanks.
I'm here for two reasons. One, to look around."
"Okay, done that.
Came a month too early, obviously. Two, I want all the frightful details of Thursday night. You and that rather attractive boy Keech left very early together. And darling, I do mean all the details."
"Keech is hardly a boy."
"Pah! Younger than me by almost a century. So tell your best cousin.
What happened?"
Araminta smiled bashfully. "You know very well. We went back to his place."
She proffered a limp gesture at the dilapidated hallway. "I could hardly bring him here."
"Excellent. And? And what? What does he do? Is he single? What's he like in bed? How many times has he called? Is he yearning and desperate yet? Has he sent flowers or jewellery? Or is he all pathetic and gone the chocolate route? Which resort bedroom are you spending the weekend in?"
"Whoa, just stop there." Araminta's smile turned sour. In truth, Keech had been more than adequate in bed, and he had even tried to call several times since Thursday, calls she had no intention of returning. The thrill of liberation, of playing the field, of experimenting, of answering to no one, of making and taking her own choices, of just plain having fun, that was all she wanted right now. A simple life without commitment or attachments, right now, was what she should have been doing instead of being married.
"Keech was very nice, but I'm not seeing him again. I'm too busy here." "Now I am impressed. Hump 'em and dump 'em. There's quite a core of raw steel hidden inside that ingenue facade, isn't there?"
Araminta shrugged.
"Whatever. If you ever want a career in law, I'll be happy to sponsor you. You'll probably make partner in under 70 years.
"Gosh, there's an enticement."
Cressida dropped her hand long enough to laugh. "Ah, well, I tried. So are we on for Wednesday?"
"Yes, of course."
Araminta enjoyed their girls' nights out. Cressida seemed to know every exclusive club in Colwyn City, and she was on all their guest lists. "So what happened to you after I left? Did you catch anyone?"
"At my age, I was safely tucked up in bed by midnight."
"Who with?"
"I forget their names."
"You know, you really must go up a level and join an orgy. They can be fantastic, especially if you have partners who know exactly what they're doing."
Araminta giggled.
"No, thanks. Don't think I'm quite ready for that yet. What I'm doing is pretty adventurous for me. Well, when you're ready, I'll let you know.
Cressida inhaled a breath of dust and started coughing.
Ozzy, this place is bringing back too many memories of my early years. Look, I'll call later. Sorry I'm not much practical help, but truthfully, I'm crap with design programs.
I want to do this by myself. I'm going to do this by myself.
Hell, make that partner in 50 years. You've got what it takes.
Remind you of you? Araminta asked sweetly.
Now I think you're sharper, unfortunately. Bye, darling.
Lunch was a sandwich in her carry capsule as she flew across the city for the first of 3 suppliers on her list. The carry capsule, like her bots, had seen better days. According to the log, she was the 5th owner in 30 years. Perfectly serviceable, the sales manager had assured her. It did not have the speed of a new model, and if the big rear cargo compartment was filled to the rated load, it would not quite reach its maximum flight ceiling. But she had a lot more confidence in the capsule than in the 8038 bot. Because of its age, it had to pass a strict Vyosha Transport Agency flightworthiness test every year, and the last one had been 2 months before she bought it. The capsule settled on a lot of Bovies bathing and culinary ware, one of 8 macro stores that made up a small touchdown mall in the Groby district. She walked into the store, looking into the open display rooms that lined a broad aisle with many branches. Bathrooms and kitchens alternated, promoting a big range of sizes, styles, and prices, though the ones by the door tended to be elaborate. She looked enviously at the larger luxury units, thinking about the kind of apartment she would develop one day, in which such extravagance was a necessity.
Can I help you?
Araminta turned around to see a man dressed in the store's blue and maroon uniform. He was quite tall, with his biological age locked in around the late 20s, dark skin offset by sandy blonde hair. Nice regular features, she thought, without being too handsome. His eyes were light grey, revealing a lot of humour. If they were meeting in a club, she definitely would let him buy her a drink. She might even offer to buy him one first.
I'm looking for a kitchen and a bathroom. Both have to look and feel high grade, yet cost practically nothing.
Ah, now that I can understand and provide for. I'm Mr. Bovey, by the way.
She was quite flattered the owner himself would come down on the floor and single her out to help.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Araminta.
He shook her hand politely. She thought he was debating with himself about whether he should try for a platonic greeting kiss. It was one of those times when she wished she had a connection to the Gaia field, which would enable her to gauge his emotions, assuming he would broadcast them, which, as the owner of the store and therefore a professional, he would not.
Damn. Come on, girl. Focus. What sort of dimensions can you give me to play with? He asked.
Araminta gave him a slightly cheeky grin, then stopped. Perhaps it wasn't a double entendre. Certainly sounded like one, though.
Here you go,
she told him as her U-shadow produced the blueprint file.
I would appreciate some help on price. This is my first renovation project. I don't want it to be my last.
Ah.
His eyes strayed to her hands, which still had lines of grime etched on the skin.
Boss and workforce. I can relate to that.
Depleted workforce today, I'm afraid. One of my bots blew up. I can't afford any more expensive mistakes.
I understand. He hesitated. You didn't get it from Bert Rennick, did you?
Yes, she said cautiously. Why?
Okay, well, for future reference, and I didn't tell you this, he's not the most reliable of suppliers.
I know he's not the gold standard, but I checked on the evaluation library for that model. It was okay.
This time he did wince. Next time you buy something in the trade, including anything from me, I'd recommend some research on Dave's coding. His U-shadow handed over the address.
The evaluation library, all those independent reports on how the product worked. Well, the library is financed and managed by corporations. That's why there's never really a bad review. Dave's coding is truly autonomous.
Thank you,
she said meekly, as she filed the address in one of her storage lacunae. I'll take an access sometime.
Glad to help. In the meantime, try R7 for a kitchen. I think we can supply your order from there.
Thanks.
She walked off to aisle 7,
more than a little disappointed that he did not accompany her. Perhaps he had a policy of not flirting with customers. Shame. The man waiting in aisle 7 had an identical blue and maroon uniform. He was perhaps 5 years older than Mr. Bovey, but even taller, with a slender marathon runner's frame. His skin was Nordic pale, with ginger hair cut short, except for a slender ridge right at the crest of his skull. Strangely, his green eyes registered the same kind of general amusement at the world as Mr. Bovey's.
"I'd recommend these two kitchen styles," he said in greeting, and gestured at a small display area. "They're a good fit to your dimensions, and this one is an end-of-the-line model. I've got two left in the warehouse, so I can give you a sweet deal."
Araminta was slightly nonplussed. Mr. Bovey obviously had passed on her file to this employee, but that was no reason for him to start off as if they already were on familiar terms. "Let's take a look," she said, lowering the temperature of her voice. It turned out the end-of-the-line model was quite satisfactory, and it was a good deal. As well as a mid-range culinary unit with a range of multi-chem storage tanks, she got a breakfast bar and stools and ancillaries, such as a fridge, a food prepper, a maid bot, shelving and cupboards. The style was chaste white, with black and gold trim. "If you throw in delivery, I'll take it," she told him.
"Any time you want it, I'll get it to you."
She ignored the flirty overture and told her U-shadow to pay the deposit.
"Bathrooms, aisle 11, he told her with unabashed enthusiasm.
The salesman waiting for her in aisle 11 had allowed himself to age into his biological 50s, which was unusual even for Vyosha. His ebony skin was just starting to crinkle, with his hair greying and thinning.
"I've got four that I think will suit your aesthetics," was his opening gambit.
"Hello," she snapped at him.
"Ah, yes?
I'm Araminta, pleased to meet you, and I'm looking for a bathroom for my flat. Can you help me?"
"What?
This whole relay thing you've got going here really isn't polite. You could at least say hi to me first before you access the file you're all shooting around here. I am a person, you know."
"I think,
His surprised expression softened. Araminta found it a lot more disconcerting than his initial smug chumminess.
"You do know what I am, don't you?" he asked.
"What do you mean?"
"I am Mr. Bovey. We are all Mr. Bovey in this store. I am a multiple human."
Araminta was certain she was turning bright red with embarrassment. She knew what a multiple was, of course. One personality shared among several bodies through an adaptation of the Gaia Field technology. This, its practitioners claimed, was the true evolutionary leap for humanity that everyone else was pursuing down futile dead ends. A multiple human could never die, unless every body was killed, which was unlikely in the extreme. In a quiet, non-evangelical way, they believed that everyone would become multiple one day. Perhaps after that the personalities would start fusing, leaving one consciousness with a trillion bodies, a much better outcome than downloading into the artificial sanctity of ANA. It was a human heresy, their detractors claimed, a long-term conspiracy to imitate the prime aliens of Dyson Alpha. More vocal opponents accused the multiple lifestyle of being started by leftover star flyer agents, trying to continue their dead master's corrupting ideology.
"I'm sorry," she said, shame-faced. "I didn't know." "That's okay. Partly my fault in assuming you did. Most people in the trade know."
Araminta gave a wry grin. "I guess continuity of service is a big plus."
"I've got to be better than Bert Rennick." "Definitely." "All right, then. So are you and I good to go and look at bathrooms?"
"Of course we are." Araminta wound up buying the third suite the older Mr. Bovey showed her. It wasn't out of guilt. He was genuinely offering a good deal, and the plain gold and green style was perfect for the flat, and once she'd let her awkwardness subside, he was fun to talk to. She could not quite throw off the weird feeling of disconnection, talking to his older body, and knowing he was exactly the same person who had greeted her, and that body probably was smiling privately at her while dealing with another customer.
"Just let us know when you want it delivered," he said, when her U-shadow handed over the deposit.
"Do you, that is, some of you handle delivery as well?"
"Don't worry. Tense hasn't caught up with us multiples yet. And yes, I'll be the one on the carry capsule and helping the bots when they get stuck on the stairs. Not necessarily this body, given its age, but me. I look forward to seeing the rest of you. There's a couple of me's who are young and handsome. Call it vanity if you like. And not immune to all the usual human flaws. I'll try and schedule them's for the delivery. As handsome as you? Hey, there's no more discount. You've squeezed me dry already. She laughed. I'd better get back to work then. Araminta smiled during the whole flight back to the flat. Mr. Bovey really had been charming. All his versions. She suspected it was more than good client relations. And was he joking about the young and handsome bodies? Actually, even the last one she had seen, the older one, had been quite distinguished. And what if he did ask her out for a date? Would it be just her and 20 of him sitting at a table? If he asks. And if he does, what am I going to answer? The whole idea was unusual, which made it very interesting. And what if the evening goes well? Do I ask 20 of him back to my place? Oh, stop it. She was still smiling when she walked back up the stairs and opened the front door. Then her mood came down at the sight of the flat. The bots had made some progress cleaning up, but the one with a vacuum attachment was all clogged up. None of the bots had self-maintenance capacity, so she would have to clear that out manually, and she still had not put the balcony door actuator back together. It could be quite a while before Mr. Bovey delivered her new kitchen and bathroom, and she got around to finding out how well she had read their encounter. Late in the afternoon, when the place was finally getting straightened out, she started spreading the sealant sheets over the lounge's floorboards. That was when her U-shadow told her there was a call from Laryl. "Are you sure?" she asked it. "Yes." She debated with herself if she should call Cressida. Maybe the revenue service would pay a reward. "Where's he calling from?" "The routing identity originates on Oaktier." A summary slid into her peripheral vision. "A central Commonwealth world," she read. "What's he doing there?" "I do not know." "Right." She sat on the cube that was her portable bed and took her gloves off, wiped her forehead, took a breath. "Okay. Accept the call." His image appeared in her exovision's primary perspective, making it seem as if he was standing right in front of her. If he were providing a real representation, he had not changed much. Thin brown hair cut short, round face with a chubby jaw and a wide neck, as always thick dark stubble, longer than she liked. It was scratchy, she remembered. He never gelled it down smooth, no matter how many times she asked. "Thanks for taking the call," he said. "I wasn't sure you would."
"Neither was I."
"I hear you're doing okay. You got the money."
"I was awarded the money by the court."
"Laryl, what are you doing? Why are you on Oaktier?" "Isn't it obvious?"
That took a few seconds to register, and even longer to accept. It had to be some stunt, some scam.
"You're migrating inward?" she asked, incredulous.
He smiled the same carefree smile he'd used when they'd first met. It was very appealing, warm and confident. She had not seen it much after they married.
"Happens to all of us in the end," he said.
"No, I don't believe it. You are going higher. You!"
"My first batch of bionics has been in a week. They're starting to integrate some basic fields. It's quite an experience."
"But," she sputtered, "for Ozzy's sake."
"Higher culture would never take you. What did you do? Erase half your memories?" "That's a pretty common myth. Higher culture isn't the old Catholic Church, you know. You don't have to confess and recant your past sins. It's current attitude which counts.
I know they don't take criminals. There was that case centuries ago. Jolyon thought that he could escape from what he had done with a memory wipe and a migration to the inner worlds. Paula Mayo caught up with him and had his bionics removed so that he could face trial on the external worlds as the type of human he had been when he committed his crime. I think he got a couple of 100 years suspension.
That's what you think of me. That I qualify for the Jolyon precedent. Well, thanks a whole lot, Araminta. A couple of things you might want to consider. One,
Paula Mayo isn't after me, and the reason she isn't is that I haven't committed any crime.
Have you told the Vyosha Revenue Service that? My business economics were a mess, sure. I'm not hiding from that. I even told my higher initiator about my finances.
You know what she said?
Go on.
Higher culture is about rejecting the evil of money.
How very convenient for you.
Look, I just wanted to call and apologize. I'm not asking for anything. And I wanted to make sure you're all right.
A bit late for that, isn't it? She bridled. I'm not part of some therapy session you have to complete before they'll take you.
You're misunderstanding this. Perhaps with anger leading you away from what I'm actually saying.
Ozzy, this is your therapy session.
We don't need therapy to become higher. It is inevitable. Even you will migrate eventually.
Never.
His image produced a fond, lopsided smile.
I remember thinking that once.
Probably when I was in my 20s. I know it probably doesn't make a lot of sense to someone your age, when every day is fresh. But after a few centuries living on the external worlds, you begin to get bored and frustrated. Every day becomes this constant battle. Politicians are corrupt and crap. Projects never get finished on time or on budget. Bureaucrats delight in thwarting you. And then there's the eternal fight for money,
which you lost.
I fed myself and my families for over 3 centuries, thank you very much. Even you came out ahead with the residue of that work. But face it, I didn't achieve much now, did I? A few tens of thousands of dollars to show for 3.5 centuries? That's not exactly leaving your mark on the universe, is it? And it's not just me. There are billions of humans who are the same. The external worlds are fun and exciting with their market economy and clashing ideologies and outward urge. Youth thrives on that kind of environment. Then there comes a day when you have to look back and take stock. You did that for me.
Oh, come on. You're blaming me for the dog's dinner you made of your affairs.
No, I'm not blaming you. Don't you get it? I'm thanking you.
I was old. It took you to reveal that to me. The contrast between us was so great, even I couldn't close my eyes to it forever. There really is no fool like an old fool, and part of that foolishness came from deluding myself. I was tired of that life and didn't want to admit it. Turning punk skunk and taking a young wife was just another way of trying to ignore what I'd become. Even that didn't work, did it? I was making both of us miserable.
That's putting it mildly, she muttered. In a way, though, it was gratifying, hearing him admit it was all his fault. I left my whole family behind because of you.
He showed her a sly smile.
And that was a bad thing?
Yeah, all right. She grinned puckishly. You did me a favor there. I'm not really cut out for 2 centuries of selling agricultural cybernetics.
I knew that the minute I set eyes on you.
So how's the world of property development coming on?
Harder than I thought, she admitted.
There are so many stupid little things that bug me.
I know. Well, imagine today's frustration multiplied by 300 years.
That's how I wound up feeling.
And now you don't?
No.
I don't believe higher culture is free of bureaucracy or corruption or idiots or useless politicians. They might not be so blatant, but they're there.
No, they're not. Well, okay, but nothing like as bad as they are in the external worlds. You see, there's no need for any of that. So many of the social problems the external worlds suffer from are born out of markets, capital, and materialism. That's what old-style economics produces. In fact, trouble is just about all it produces. The cybernated manufacturing and resource allocation procedure, which higher culture is based on, takes all of those difficulties out of the equation. That, and taking a mature, sensible perspective, we don't struggle for the little things anymore. We can afford to take the longer intellectual view.
You talk like you're one of them already.
Them. That's perspective for you. Higher culture is mainly a state of mind, but backed up by physical affluence.
You are what the external world strive to be. Everyone's a millionaire.
No. Everyone has equal access to resources. That's what you lack. Though I'd point out that external worlds always convert to higher culture in the end. We are the apex of human social and technological achievement. In other words,
This is what the human race has been aiming for since proto-humans picked up a club to give us an advantage against all the other predators competing for food on the African plains. We improve ourselves at every opportunity.
So why didn't you go straight to ANA and download?
That's how hires improve themselves, isn't it? Ultimately, I will, I suppose. But higher is the next stage for me. I want a time in my body which isn't such an effort. A couple of centuries where I can just relax and learn. There are so many things I want to do and see which I never could before. The opportunities here are just astounding.
Araminta laughed silently. That sounded like the old Laryl. Then I suppose I wish you good luck.
Thank you. I really didn't want to leave things the way they were between us. If there's anything you ever need, please call, even if it's just a shoulder to cry on.
Sure. I'll do that, she lied, knowing she never would. She felt indecently content when he ended the call. Closure obviously worked both ways.
The people had no faces, at least none that he was aware of. There were dozens of them, men, women, even children. They were in front of him, running, fleeing like cattle, panicked by a carnivore. Their screams threatened to split his eardrums. Words rose, struggling out of the sound wall. Mostly they were pleas for help, for pity, for sanctuary, for their lives. However hard they ran, he kept up with them. The bizarre melee was taking place in some kind of elaborate hall with crystal grooves running across its domed ceiling. Rows of curving chairs hindered the frantic crowd as they raced for the exit doors. He would not or could not turn around. He did not know what they were trying to escape from. Energy weapons screeched, and the people flung themselves down. For himself, he remained standing, looking down at their prone bodies. Somehow he was remote from the horror. He did not know how that could be. He was there with them. He was a part of whatever terror was happening there. Then some kind of shadow slid across the floor, like demon wings unfolding. Aaron sat up in bed with a shocked gasp. His skin was cold, damp with sweat. His heart was pounding. It took a moment for him to recognize where he was. The lights in the sleeping cabin were brightening, showing him the curving bulkhead walls. He blinked at them as the dream faded. Somehow he knew the strange images were more than a dream. They must be some memory of his previous life, an event strong enough to cling on inside his neurons while the rest of his identity was wiped. He was curious and daunted at the same time. What the hell did I get myself mixed up in? As he thought about it, whatever the affray was, it did not look any worse than anything this mission had generated so far. His heart had calmed without any help from his bionics. He took a deep breath and climbed off the cot. "Where are we?" he asked the artful Dodger's smart core.
6 hours out from Anagaska.
Good. He stretched and rolled his shoulders. "Give me a shower," he told the smart core. "Start with water. Shift to spores when I tell you." The cabin began to change, the cot flowing back into the bulkhead, the floor hardening to a black and white marble finish. Gold nozzles extruded from each corner and warm water gushed out. Even given the ship's obvious higher origin, it had come as a wondrous surprise to discover it was equipped with an ultra-drive. Aaron had thought such a thing to be nothing more than rumor. That was when he realized he had to be working for some ANA faction. It was an idea he found more intriguing than the drive. It also meant the pilgrimage was being taken a lot more seriously than people generally realized. After the spores cleaned and dried his skin, he dressed in a simple dark purple one-piece suit and went out into the main lounge. His small cabin withdrew into the bulkhead, providing a larger floor space. Corilin's cabin was still engaged, a simple blister shape protruding into the hemispherical lounge. His suggestion the previous day that they share a bunk had been met by a cold stare and an instant, "Good night." She probably would not come out again until they touched down. The culinary unit provided an excellent breakfast of fried Benjeet eggs and Wiltshire dry-cured bacon, with toast and thick English marmalade. Aaron was nothing if not a traditionalist. "So it would seem," he mused. Corilin emerged from her cabin while he was munching on his third slice of toast. She had dressed in a demure, for her, turquoise and emerald knee-length cashmere sweater dress that the ship's synthesizer had produced. Her cabin sank back into the bulkhead,
and she collected a large cup of tea from the culinary unit before sitting down opposite Aaron. Recognizing a person's emotional state was an important part of Aaron's assessment routine, but this morning Coriolan was as unreadable as a muted solido. She stared at him for a while as she sipped her tea, apparently unperturbed by the awkwardness of the situation. "Something on your mind?" he asked mildly, breaking the silence. That he was the one who broke it was a telling point. There were not many people who could make him socially uncomfortable.
"Not my mind," she said a little too earnestly.
"Meaning?" "Oh, come on. You're an attractive woman. I was bound to ask. You'd probably be more insulted if I didn't."
"Not what I'm talking about."
She waved her hand dismissively.
"That was some dream you had."
"I... dream? Did you forget?
I didn't become a living dream counselor just because I've got a great ass. I immerse myself in people's dreams. I explore their emotional state and try to help them come to terms with what they are. Dreams are very revealing."
"Oh, shit. I leaked that into the Gaia field."
"You certainly did. I'd like to tell you that you are one very disturbed individual, but that would hardly be a revelation now, would it?"
"I've seen my fair share of combat. Hardly surprising my subconscious throws up crap like that." She gave a small victory smile.
"But you don't remember any combat, do you? Not previous to this particular incarnation. That means that whatever event you participated in was truly epochal for it to have survived in your subconscious. Wipe techniques are generally pretty good these days, and I suspect you had access to the very best."
"Come off it. That was too weird to be a memory. Most dreams are engendered by memory. Except Inigo's, of course. They have their roots in reality, in experience. What you see is the event as your real personality recognizes it."
"Dreams are very truthful things, Aaron. They're not something you can ignore or take an aerosol to ward off. Unless you face that which you dream, you will never truly be at peace with yourself."
"Do I cross your palm with silver now?"
"Sarcasm is a very pitiful social defense mechanism, especially in these circumstances. Both of us know how disturbed you were. You cannot shield yourself and your emotions from someone as experienced as myself. The Gaia field will show you for what you are."
Aaron made very sure the Gaia motes were completely closed, allowing nothing to escape from inside his skull.
"Okay, then," he grumbled. "What was I dreaming?" "Something in your past."
"Hey, wow. Surely I am in the presence of a truly galactic master of the art." Unperturbed, Coriolan took another drink of tea.
"More relevantly, a darkness from your past. In order to have survived erasure and to manifest so strongly, I would evaluate it as a crux in your psychological development. Those people were very frightened, terrified even. For so many to be running so fearfully, the threat must have been lethal. That is rare in the Commonwealth today, even among the outermost external worlds.
So I was running an evacuation mission out of some disaster. Rare, but not unfeasible. There's a lot that goes on among external worlds that the more developed planets turn a blind eye to." Coriolan gave him a sad smile.
"You were above them, Aaron. Remember? Not running with them. You were what they feared. You and what you represented."
"That's bullshit.
Men, women, children, all fleeing you. All hysterical and horror-struck. What were you going to do to them, I wonder? We established back at the Fane that you have no conscience."
"Very clever," he sneered. "I pissed you off. And now you come gunning for a little psychological payback. Lady, I have to tell you, it takes a great deal more than anything you've got to spook me out. And that's Ozzy's honest truth."
"I'm not trying to spook you anywhere, Aaron," she said with quiet earnestness. "That's not what living dream, the true living dream, is about. We exist to guide human life to its fulfillment. The promise of the void is a huge part of that, yes. But it is not the only component to understanding what you are, your basic nature. I want to liberate the potential inside you. There is more than senseless violence lurking inside your mind. I can sense that. You can be so much more than what you are today if you just let me help. We can explore your dreams together."
Call me old-fashioned, but my dreams are my own. The darkness you witnessed at the end interests me. That shadow. Despite himself, Aaron was curious she'd picked up on it. A winged shadow, which has a strong resonance for most humans, no matter which cultural stream they come from. But it was more than a simple shadow. It held significant meaning for you. A representation of your subconscious, I think. After all, it didn't surprise you. If anything, you felt almost comfortable with it. Whatever. We have more important things to concentrate on right now. Touchdown is in 5.5 hours. Something in his mind was telling him to close this conversation now. She was trying to distract him, to throw him off guard. He could not allow that. He had to remain completely focused on his mission to locate Inigo. Coriolan raised an eyebrow. Are you seriously saying you're not interested? This is the real you we're talking about. I keep telling you, I'm happy with what I am. Now you said Inigo came to Anagasca to visit his family. She gave him a disheartened gaze. I said he visited his homeworld on occasion, when everything got too much for him. All I know is that he had family. Any further inference is all your own. His mother migrated inward, then downloaded into ANA. What about the aunt? I don't know. Did the aunt have children? Cousins he would have grown up with? I don't know. Was there a family estate? A refuge he felt secure in? I don't know. He sat back and just about resisted glaring at her. His official biography says he grew up in Kumo. Please tell me that isn't a lie. I'd assume it was correct. That is, I have no reason to doubt it. It's where Living Dream built his library. Central worship point for your living God, huh? I'm not surprised you don't want to know yourself. You're a real shit. You know that. The good ship Artful Dodger slipped back into real space, 1,000 kilometers above Anagasca. Aaron told the smart core to register with the local Space Watch network and request landing permission at Kuhum Spaceport. The request was granted immediately, and the starship began its descent into the middle of the cloud-smeared eastern continent. When it was confirmed as H congruous and assigned for settlement by Compression Space Transport back in 2375, Anagasca was an unremarkable world in what then was called Phase 3 space, destined for a long, slow development. Then the Starflyer plunged the Commonwealth into war against the Prime Aliens, and its future changed radically. Hanko was one of the 47 planets that had been wrecked during the Prime's last great assault against the Commonwealth, its sun pummeled by flare bombs and quantum busters, saturating the defenseless planet's climate and biosphere with a torrent of lethal radiation for weeks on end. Its 150 million strong population was trapped under city force fields on a dying world whose very air was now deadly poison. Evacuation was the only possible option. And thanks to Nigel Sheldon and the CST company operating Hanko's wormhole link, its citizens were shunted across 42 light-years to Anagasca. Unfortunately, Anagasca at the time was nothing more than wild forest, native prairie and hostile jungle, with a grand total of 5 pre-settlement research stations housing a few hundred scientists. Nigel had a solution even to that. The interior of the wormhole transporting Hanko's population to their new home was given a different, very slow, temporal flow rate relative to the outside universe. With the war over, trillions of dollars was poured into creating an infrastructure on Anagasca with the other 46 refuge worlds. It took over a century to complete the basic civic amenities and housing, producing cities and towns that were nearly Stalinist in their layout and architecture. But when the wormhole from Hanko finally opened on Anagasca, all those who came through were provided with a roof over their heads and enough food to sustain them while they built up their new homes, agriculture and industry. It was perhaps inevitable that after such a trauma, the refuge worlds were slow to develop economically. Their major cities progressed sluggishly in an era when the rest of the Commonwealth was undergoing profound change. As to the outlying towns, they became nearly stagnant backwaters. Nobody starved, nobody was particularly poor, but they lacked the dynamism that was sweeping the rest of humanity as bionics became available. ANA came online,
and new political and cultural blocs were formed. Kumo was such a town. Little had changed in the 7 centuries between the day its new residents arrived, stumbling out of giant government transporters, and the time Inigo was born. When he was a child, the massive hexagonal arcology, built to house his ancestors, still dominated the center of the civic zone, its uninhabited upper levels decaying alarmingly, while its lower floors offered cheap accommodation to underprivileged families and third-rate businesses. In fact, it was still there, 60 years later, when he left, a monstrous civic embarrassment to a town that did not have the money to refurbish or demolish it. 100 years later, the arcology's upper third finally had been dismantled with funds from Anagasca's federal government made available for public safety. Then Living Dream made the town council a financial offer it couldn't really refuse. The arcology finally was raised, and its denizens rehoused in plush new suburbs built expressly for them. Where it had stood, a new building emerged, nowhere near as big, but far more important. Living Dream had constructed what was to be Anagasca's primary fane, with a substantial library and a free college attached. It attracted the devout from across the planet, and a good many nearby star systems, many of them staying, changing the nature of Kumo forever. Aeron stood under the tall Novik trees that dominated the fane's encircling park, and looked up at the tapering turrets with their bristling bracelets of stone sculptures, his nose wrinkling in dismay. "The arcology couldn't have been worse than this," he declared.
"This is your leader's ultimate temple. His statement to his birthplace that he's moved onward and upward. Damn, he must have really hated his old town to do this to it. All this says to me is beware of Kumoyans bearing gifts."
Coraline sighed and shook her head. "Ozzy, but you are such a Philistine. Know what I like, though? And, lady, this ain't it. Even the old Big 15 worlds had better architecture than this. So what are you going to do? Hit it with a disruptor pulse. Tempting, I have to admit, but no. We'll indulge in a little data mining first."
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.